thank you for pausing during your busy day to enjoy tea with Crystal, a glimpse inside a storyteller's mind. This podcast is brought to you by the Purple Prose Room and Harry Buns Productions, written, narrated, and produced by Crystal Brady Young, author of the book series Fate's Champions and Tea with Friends Cookbook. Copyright 2021. Good morning. Welcome to episode 8. Pardon me if I sound half asleep. I'm still waking up. In order to record audio with a minimum of noise interference, I need to do it very early in the morning, especially now that a hot Texas summer is already upon us. This is the only time of day the AC can remain off long enough for me to get some work done. Which brings us to today's topic. It's not a sacrifice. I'm actually ahead of schedule adding audio media to my publishing and production plans. I knew it would need to be done eventually, but I had not set a firm date for starting. I was thinking possibly toward the end of this year. Then this past November, two different people told me I really needed to do audiobooks soon. On the same day. Depending on one's belief system, some people would call that a sign from God. There's one tiny problem with those. They tend to occur when you least expect them, meaning you're usually not ready. Crap. I went from having a relatively easy year ahead of me, with book 3 already begun and possibly published by early summer, then hopefully book 4 by the end of the year. Instead, I've been working on book 3 in between writing and recording podcasts, doing the prep to record 2 audiobooks, and now a collection of recipes to go with our tea. In case you're wondering, this kind of insanity isn't new to me. Pay close attention and you'll begin to notice I'm not a linear thinker. One project often inspires another, and in the case of my little writing publishing endeavor, it all circles back to a main theme. Some folks might want to label it as building a brand. Sure, I guess it is, though a website wasn't even a twinkle in my eye when I painted my office purple. Perhaps the color choice could be attributed to divine inspiration. I will admit, somewhat grudgingly, owning an e-commerce store does mean having more than just 2 books as inventory. Otherwise, visitors wouldn't have much of a reason to return frequently. I began my expansion by prepping for Heart of a Star's audiobook, but before doing any recording on it, decided it would be best to do a podcast series first. Yes, that was another save for later bubbling on the back burner, but it got moved to the front of the stove after I concluded its shorter format would probably be good practice for learning audio production and editing. Rather than jumping feet first into the deep end with 2 100,000-ish word books. Producing audio properly comes with a whole other set of considerations you don't normally think about until you begin doing it. Cultivating the talent to inject personality into your narrating is just the starting point. You should also consider your voice as an instrument, just as professional singers do. I have issues with coughing, some of it due to asthma and a lot of it due to acid reflux. We'll just say, besides nearly perpetual heartburn, it tended to make my throat a bit gunky. I had my suspicions concerning the main culprit, and while I may not have consumed copious amounts, it was enough to cause problems. I like dairy. It does not like me back, and the problem has become more pronounced over the past year. It's a classic example of a one-sided friendship. Coming from my Seventh-day Adventist background, where a healthy diet is very much a part of their ministry, making substitutions for animal products is nothing new to me. What was very much fringe when I was growing up is now mainstream with a lot more choices. Letting go of something you happen to like is usually the main issue when a change needs to be made. This is where developing the ability to widen your perspective is a really useful skill. Even that snooty food critic, Monsieur Anton Ego, was a big fan of fresh perspective, specifically when he was the one providing it. I've told my husband many times when he needs to make health-related changes, you're not giving something up, you're trading it for something better. I actually like many of the dairy alternatives now available, and while I haven't completely eliminated it, I keep seeking opportunities to cut back. It provides a worthy challenge in the kitchen, and some of the recipes I've developed for tea with friends use plant-based dairy alternatives, or they simply never contained it in the first place. To make lasting changes in our personal lives, they have to be seen as positive. Let's not forget, very few of our decisions are ever isolated as single incidents. In fact, circles and spirals dominate nature. Not just here on our planet, but throughout the entire universe. What goes around, comes around. If we're not careful, what returns to us could be a much bigger issue than we anticipated. However, if you're in the habit of looking for your blessings, both big and small, you'll begin to notice how making wise choices magnifies even more than poor ones. Eventually, they may even grow enough to benefit others. Removing dairy from my diet is having this effect. Besides making my stomach feel better and eliminating a lot of coughing, some of it hard enough I almost couldn't breathe, it's also minimizing the issues I'm beginning to have with arthritis. There are a few joints in my fingers which are probably never going to heal completely, since they are a bit deformed now. But given enough time, you never know. As long as I keep reminding myself of all the benefits this change is providing, they might eventually get close to normal again. At least I'm having fewer issues with pain. A good thing since I use my hands constantly. Feeling better also means I'm not as irritable, a change Carl definitely appreciates. The main issue with the word sacrifice is the baggage attached to it. Historically, it's rarely done voluntarily, at least not by the individual ultimately paying the price. They're victims, supposedly providing a service for the greater good of their community or enemies. On the other hand, martyrdom, which is usually seeking a similar outcome, is a voluntary act motivated by one's beliefs. Here's an example I can provide from personal experience, to which a few of you can probably relate. The world at large tends to label military service as a sacrifice, and during the years men over the age of 18 were required to register for the draft, it was a sacrifice. In the United States, joining the military is now voluntary, placing it firmly under the definition of martyrdom, at least in my book. It's the families of those martyrs who are making sacrifices, because they aren't being given any choice over how their loved one's devotion to his or her country is being used. Because I love efficiency, I'm a firm believer in getting maximum value out of most projects I undertake, especially those which I believed no longer mattered to me. Returning to writing was not just about a form of self-therapy. It was also a means for me to work again, on terms better suited to my current circumstances, so I could still honor the main reason I left my last job. I became a full-time caregiver to keep my husband from falling down the stairs and sustaining even more serious injuries, or, heaven forbid, breaking his neck and dying alone. I have mentioned, despite what I have accomplished thus far, devoting my limited leisure time to new business isn't always pure joy. Sure, selling my books is nice, but the true value goes deeper and bears far more significance. It provided some much-needed motivation to quit procrastinating. We've allowed ourselves to be overtaken by chaos here, sometimes by simply not making timely decisions, and now find ourselves digging out from underneath them, literally. I needed a dedicated workspace if I was serious about actually getting a book or two published. Since our older daughter's room is my sewing studio, that meant clearing out our younger daughter's room of its clutter. While I was trying to stay on my production schedule for books 1 and 2, I wiggled a portable table into a space and made do. By the time I began wrapping up the Pearl Diver's song last spring, I was tired of looking at the disorder, not to mention I didn't find the orange paint color particularly soothing. To be fair, not all of the clutter was Kristen's. I needed some furniture for my new space, which led to staking my claim on 2 pieces of cabinet-grade oak plywood. That plywood had been occupying real estate in our garage for several years, making it fair game in my book. My husband had basically planned to scrap it by using it in a project at his Dearly's, because he said it would no longer take varnish. Though it did have some stains due to our 2018 Great Garage Flood, it wasn't warped or delaminated. Since I planned to paint it gray anyway, I didn't care and convinced him to let me make something nicer with it. Some of it became the tops for an L-shaped desk. Keeping the structure simple and purchasing 2 sets of hairpin legs meant the remaining plywood could be used to make 2 bookshelves, a project my husband and I completed a little at a time. Using that material fit into my goal of creating my workspace by using what we already had as much as possible. Now this room ended up purple and became the inspiration for my e-commerce bookstore, as explained in the Purple Prose Room page of my website. There's even an extra bonus. Adjusting my mindset that I wasn't giving something up or making sacrifices with these changes gave me the subject for this podcast episode. I was determined to do at least 10 episodes for season 1. I now have 4 additional topics, which are the start for season 2. Thanks to writing nearly every day for the past 2 years, I have plenty of practice writing at least 3,000 words within a day or two, and can usually complete revisions on shorter projects within that window, too. Recording is still a bit frustrating most days. I tend to be a perfectionist, but soon I might be good enough at punch and roll to make it my new best friend. Let's go even further with this topic. I've mentioned a few times I'm really not that special, nor am I doing things no one else can do. Motivation is always going to come back to one's perspective. How open is it to multiple ideas, and why are you doing something in the first place? Artistic activities were always my playtime reward, something I got to do after the daily living chores were finished. That's the way I was raised, meaning it's an ingrained habit. My decision to take complete control of my publishing business was not just about business. I also wanted to preserve my pleasure in the creative process. A lot of that gets sucked away when someone else dictates the terms of your work. Society at large considers competition a good thing when it motivates improvement and innovation. But for me, it mostly causes anxiety I don't need these days. Since I'm not seeking a traditional publisher or agent, entering writing contests doesn't really provide bang for my bucks anymore. Those with a slower judging process also don't suit my work habits. I entered my local RWA chapter's writing contest in 2019, shortly after I began Heart of a Star. This particular competition was created for unpublished writers and judged a book's first chapters, up to 5,000 words. I knew my novel writing skills were a bit rusty, and like many others, I initially entered to receive feedback from established professionals. It's crucial to hook an audience at the beginning of any story, and it's always nice to know if your efforts are successful. The first round comments were helpful, and as mentioned previously, I was selected as one of 3 finalists. But by the time they reached that last stage, I had a significantly different book than what I initially entered. I didn't feel it was appropriate to submit my most recent work, because it not only had a completed first draft. The entire book had already been edited and revised a few times. Very little of the original entry remained, and I didn't want to confuse matters in the final round. I never expected to be a finalist, and their timeline ultimately didn't jive with my deadlines, let alone those fleeting moments of inspiration I wished to capture. Then there's the not-so-little matter of a traditional author's work, sitting in an acquisition editor's slush pile, possibly as long as a few years, if it's seen at all. That is time I can use for book production and copyright registration of my completed manuscripts. I also had my own ideas concerning titles and cover art design. The book titles come from the jewelry pieces on the covers, and they're not just precious objects. They're major story characters, who are sentient beings with dialogue. I guess one could think of them as being a similar concept to crystal skulls, although other fantasy readers, especially those closer to my age, might be familiar with the Belgariad series. When it comes to editing, I'm not without other support options. We have a good friend who did plenty of work-related writing. He's also well-read, though historical romance isn't his normal cup of tea. He helped with Heart of a Star. Then there's my recently retired brother-in-law, who has a master's degree in English. Frankly, I would prefer to work with either of them, precisely because they aren't publishing industry insiders. When you're forging a path of your own, it's invaluable to have assistance from someone who can provide a fresh perspective. The feedback Dave gave on my first book, which I mostly heeded, probably contributed to Owen's enjoyment of the story. I don't think it was simply because he found the hero relatable. Women aren't the only ones seeking a partner who is fully invested in them. The heroine's feelings for her man were mutual, and she wasn't shy about expressing them. Their bonding process was mostly straightforward, creating a more interesting challenge for me, because the tension needed to come from elsewhere. Not to mention, the hero's mother was very active in assuring they began their lives together with a firm foundation, based on respect. If you're writing relationship stories, why wouldn't you create something which appeals to both halves of the real-life equation? Well, I do love bookstores and libraries. I rarely go into them anymore. Some of that is due to physical proximity. Despite all the retail opportunities developing around us, bookstores aren't one I can find in my immediate proximity. We live in a heavily populated urban area. These days, there has to be a really good reason for me to get into my vehicle and tolerate the traffic. It's been like that ever since I gave up my last job in 2013. And it will take more than seeing one of my books on physical store shelves to make it worth my while. Once I've created it, I can put digital inventory on my website in a matter of minutes, all from the comfort of my purple office chair. I suppose there are some advantages to the mass market approach as a way to be discovered, but it's also very wasteful. Print copies which don't sell in a certain time period are destroyed. Sure, I received an initial thrill seeing my first two books listed all over the place on the internet, when they first came out. However, there seems to be a major discrepancy between the number of copies produced, sold by my distributor, versus what appeared to be available on the market. While still in my teens, I added a few craft-oriented interests to my creative repertoire, and I'm a tactile person because of it. Not to mention, I have a bit of nostalgia for printed books. Digital versions weren't available when I learned to read. There is still something about turning a real page to see what happens next. Not to mention the materials chosen to produce a book are secret language all their own. Nice covers and smooth, high-quality papers are an indication the publisher believed enough in the story. They were willing to invest more in its production values. Print books will remain part of my inventory, but only as handmade custom heirlooms, sold in limited quantities. In the age of oversharing, I get it. That posted photo showing someone's home library, with shelves full of books, is still a status symbol. But how many of us think about what will become of them when we run out of room, need to move, or after we die? Boxes of old books are common inventory at garage and estate sales. You might have the rare person seeking hidden gems, but most books will be the last thing to sell, if they sell at all. I have taken my boxes of books to half-price books, which is a perfectly viable option. Because they sell those books for a fraction of the original price, they only pay pennies on the dollar, even for expensive hardbound books. That means the mass-produced books people purchase are the opposite of long-term financial investments. Some may believe taking a pre-order-only approach for print copies will sacrifice sales and exposure. Just because my novels have registered copyrights and ISBNs doesn't mean I'm obligated to report my sales in an effort to make a list or two. It's a meritocracy-based marketing tool, which has never had any particular meaning to my own reading choices. Though it may make growth slower, it's an approach which aligns with my values. I'm not about being exclusive to a limited audience, so much as being responsible with ever-dwindling resources. The paper industry not only uses a lot of trees, though most of the raw material is scrap from the lumber industry. The process requires a lot of water. This is why paper mills have historically been built near rivers. The bleaching process required to make paper white is a major polluter. The same goes for the dyes to create other colors. They now use eco-friendly as a marketing buzzword for many of their products. But unless you see the manufacturing process for yourself, there is no choice except taking them at their word. The commercial printing process isn't without environmental issues either. Whether it's traditional solvent-based ink or digital print on demand, there is always waste involved. It varies from large-scale machinery, which eventually breaks down or becomes obsolete, the parts required for repairs, one-time-use printing plates, the extra paper and ink required to register multicolored printing, and toner cartridges, which can't be refilled. Personal electronic devices come with their own set of issues concerning sustainability. But as Alton Brown often says, that's a subject for another show. It may be no more than a different devil, but through my website, I can offer signed copies all the time and ship them to someone whom I may never get to meet in person. In my empire, there are no laws which declare local book signings must be held in bookstores. I would far rather do one-on-one meetings with my local readers anyway, instead of large events. I have enough on my plate already that I don't need the additional stress of planning those. There are plenty of places nearby where I can support another small business while getting acquainted with a new friend. Businesses which offer food and beverages seem like a win-win to me. Taking prepaid orders for non-digital products not only simplifies this approach, since I won't make any physical merchandise until someone commits to an item, I don't have a lot of inventory occupying my house based upon speculation. When it comes to events, I will make one exception, because planning it wouldn't be 100% my responsibility. Book signing benefits for charitable organizations. Donations made through a book presale could be given to the recipient organization during the event, allowing those who made a purchase to be part of the giant check presentation. Not to mention, no one has to worry about collecting payments. I can concentrate on the book signing itself, and those who prepaid are guaranteed to get a copy that day. If they happen to bring friends with them, no worries. Friends would always have the option of ordering copies and receiving the special one-on-one treatment later. The purchase would still benefit the charity, too. At the end of the day, what I do with this venture is only limited by my imagination and what I'm brave enough to attempt. Investing in ourselves and those we love is never a sacrifice. And in case you thought there would be no storytelling references today, you thought wrong. This time I'm going to discuss A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. I'm not a huge fan of most romantic and Victorian period literature. I consider most stories from these eras rather depressing. What can you say, except that they reflected their times. I had to read this book for my high school senior literature class. I was 18 at the time. Thanks to that water under the bridge of life, I can now view this story with a different perspective and definitely more appreciation. The French Revolution may seem like an unusual story subject for a Victorian-era writer, but it made perfect sense for Dickens. Not to mention, during his lifetime it was not yet ancient history. Dickens used his stories to expose the continued inequities of British society, the very same inequities created at the dawn of all civilizations, to maintain the status quo. The French Revolution was the definitive event to occur during the Age of Enlightenment, fueled in no small part by philosophers like Voltaire. Only like all revolutions, it not only swept up those truly guilty of trampling over their fellow man, it also sacrificed those deemed guilty by association, like the protagonist Charles Darnay. A man of good character, he in no way deserved execution at the hands of a rabid mob, drunk on their newfound power. Dickens also provided an anti-hero in Sidney Carton. Although they looked very similar, one could argue he is the yin to Charles Yang. In other words, Charles' opposite. Though it is deemed a sacrifice, Sidney's final act as a substitute is really the gift of a martyr. Do you remember the difference? One is involuntary and the other is an act of love. Though he was about to die a swift yet horrible death by switching places with Charles, Sidney also saw a gift in it for himself, redemption, illustrated by the following prophetic passage. I see a beautiful city and a brilliant people rising from this abyss, and, in their struggles to be truly free, in their triumphs and defeats through long years to come, I see the evil of this time and of the previous time, of which this is the natural birth, gradually making expiation for itself and wearing out. I see that child who lay upon her bosom and who bore my name, a man winning his way up in that path of life which once was mine. I see him winning it so well that my name is made illustrious there by the light of his. It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. It is a far, far better rest I go to than I have ever known. Because he was blinded by his demons, Sidney failed to see he already possessed redeeming qualities, such as quietly fighting for underdogs behind the scenes. Despite his flaws, those who took a chance to truly know him, like the Darnay family, loved him. Anti-heroes seem to be popping up with regularity in my little universe recently, which means someone is sending me a message I either need to heed or share in my capacity as a storyteller. I have now watched the first two episodes of Loki on Disney+. While working to earn the trust of a super-secret organization, who has arrested him for crimes against the sacred timeline, he says something rather profound all of us should remember. This may not be an exact quote, but it goes something like this. I'm an adult, not a child. I know something the child Loki would not. Good people aren't 100% good, and bad people aren't 100% bad. We tend to forget that these days, seeing everything in strict black and white, just like the yin and yang symbol. We're too quick to judge others, assume entire groups of people are guilty by association, and have totally forgotten how forgiveness really works. Religion will always be problematic because it's burdened with baggage designed to maintain a self-centered status quo. Like the true cosmic creations that they are, redemption and forgiveness are gifts, rather than something we have to earn. True redemption, granted by higher powers, does begin by asking for their forgiveness. But you do not have to attain any sort of perfection first. In order for the gift to make any significant difference in our lives, the next step is forgiving ourselves for our mistakes. Once you have done that, you seek absolution from those you have harmed. Seeking redemption is the ultimate gift we give ourselves. In all fairness, let's be clear about the other half of this process. Those who have been wronged are not excused from doing nothing. You should always be prepared to take the first step in reconciliation, by willingly forgiving another, whether they seek it or not. It just might be the catalyst which sets them onto the path of redemption. Even if it does nothing to positively change another person, forgiving them is the first step in the process of healing yourself. You will never be able to set yourself free from the pain and move forward without this critical necessity. Don't get me wrong. Forgiving someone doesn't mean you're obligated to continue a toxic relationship. It's the exact opposite. Yes, both of these processes are painful because they force us to confront the not-so-wonderful parts of our personalities and humble ourselves before others. They are critical tools in preserving our most important treasures, the relationships which enrich our lives in ways which we often overlook. It is our personal connections which define us. When humankind emerges into a new day, shining bright with peace and limitless possibilities, we will realize making the journey together was never a sacrifice. You are listening to Season 1 of Tea with Crystal. This is Episode 8, It's Not a Sacrifice. Narrated by Crystal Rady Young and produced by Harry Buns Productions, exclusively for the Purple Prose Room. Copyright 2021.